south of the border, down Mexico way. That's where I fell in love when the stars above came out to play. And now as I wander.
Hello there, all you expat wannabes. I'm Johnny Mueller, and you're listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America, the show that tells you just what it's like to live, work, play, and or retire down here in Latin America. It's a mix of the good, the bad, the ugly, and the great, and it's all right here, so let's get started. All right, let's start with a rather interesting, even edgy email from Lester. He says, Dear Johnny, you talk about working for the man or working for government like it's a terrible thing. You say it's a treadmill, it's soul-killing and all that. Well, I beg to differ. I, for one, am not the entrepreneurial sort. No one in my family ever had their own business, so I wouldn't even know where to start. I heard you say a long time ago that Latinos will start up a little business right out their front door, or their living room, or their garage, because they can never really live on the minimum wage and they have to supplement their income. So they're used to doing that. Grandpa had a little storefront tienda, little Julio sold ice cream bars on the corner, that kind of thing. I've been to Cancun. I've seen it. So for Latinos and some gringos, I guess, it's no great leap to just go ahead and stick your neck out and start a business. Well, Johnny, you're just not considering all the rest of us guys and gals who work for somebody. We work for the man or the government. And you seem to think we're not totally satisfied, that our souls are being crushed, we're being dehumanized and all that. Well, like I said, I beg to differ. You don't know. I personally get satisfaction at the end of the day, having transferred one big pile of paperwork from my inbox to my outbox in a most successful and satisfactory way. And I always get glowing performance reviews from my boss on that count, and thus steady pay raises too. And when I'm finished up at 3:30, I look at my nice, clean, orderly desk and my big stack of papers that have more or less miraculously shifted to the outbox. I say to myself, Lester, job well done. Yep, I have to say, every time I leave the office, I feel good about myself. What's wrong with that? So, Johnny, why are you trying to divest me and my other compadres of those small pleasures? I remember you talking many times about happiness. If I remember right, you said, life's worth living, or something like that, as long as you can capture a moment's happiness every day. I agree, and I'm one of those guys. Oh, and by the way, Johnny, right outside my nice, clean cubicle, there's a little break station, and the man, as you call him, provides free coffee all day long, all we can drink. So what's not to love about that? You talk about the man as if he's a jerk. My man, that would be the Canadian version of your Uncle Sam, is a really nice, benevolent guy. So Johnny, bottom line is, please don't pigeonhole all of us people working for government and for the man as lemmings and lunkheads. We're not. A lot of us are truly happy. Meanwhile, neighbors and friends right down my own street are getting laid off here and there. Plants are closing. And in that regard, I guess I really am a lucky guy. I work for government. I'm in a union. I can't get laid off. In fact, my department's on the grow. You know, it's funny. I can't think of a single person in the 18 years I've been on the job who's ever been laid off. Seems like we're always hiring. Oh, and Johnny, if you read this on the air, I'm sure your listeners are going to wonder why I listen to your show at all if I'm happy where I'm at. Well, you know what, Johnny? I'm kind of forced to listen to your show because my wife loves it. Yep, she's one of those that doesn't like her job much. She doesn't like what's going down in the States. She's hooked on all that alternative radio jive. And she really is drawing up one of those so-called Plan Bs of yours. So I suppose eventually I'll see you at one of your seminars. She's planning on coming to one of those things soon, and she'll drag me along, I'm sure. So as for why I listen to your show, it's that I'm kind of forced to. Because you see, every time I get in the car and turn on the ignition, there's that Johnny Mueller voice coming out of all six speakers. Because you see, my wife's got your shows programmed into the radio somehow, and if I mess with that, well, you know, it's just going to start an argument. And even if I win it, you know what they say about arguing with your wife? The last word you use to win the argument is the same word that starts the next argument. So, Johnny, really, I can't be the Lone Ranger here. Would you say there are lots of married couples who are on opposing sides of the fence when it comes to having that so-called Plan B? Meaning one of them is gung-ho and the other just wishes the whole subject would fade away? One more thing, Johnny. I'm only 2 years away from my pension, and I can easily do those 2 years in my sleep. Like I said, I like my job. So you might see my wife down there a lot sooner than you're going to see me. Oh, and Johnny, don't think I don't like your show or don't think it's somewhat entertaining. I kind of like the South of the Border song Dean Martin sings at the front and back end of it. It is catchy, you know. Signed, Lester from Calgary, Canada. All right, thanks for that, Lester, but I kind of think it was tongue-in-cheek. I mean, really, you're from Canada, right? Should know better. You know, the fact that you're living in Canada, that says a lot. It's always been on the nanny state forefront. And I think, truthfully, about a third to half the people in the whole country work for the government or have some kind of government contract. Now, Lester, first, let's talk a second about that free coffee thing. Nothing's free, you know? I guess that's a lesson no one learns if they're working for government, huh? But I will tell you this, Les. If you're living in a place like Guatemala, Salvador, Brazil, Colombia, or any of the places that grow really good, world-class coffee, you'll find nearly all business offices and retail stores and such have a little table set up stocked with high-grade, high-octane, local coffee. Free for all the workers and customers walking in. Just help yourself. And of course, it's not really free. I mean, they're selling a product, so it's coming out of expenses. In fact, in some of the big retail joints and franchises, they'll actually have a nice, expensive Italian imported espresso machine. In fact, just 2 days ago, I was at a car dealership where they had one. And of course, the coffee was free, or free in a sense, but paid for by somebody. Whereas free coffee or free anything when you're working for government is being paid for technically by money they pickpocketed from the citizens, otherwise known as taxes. Oh, and Lester, you referred to the situation where couples come down and one is really on board with doing a plan B and the other, not so much or not at all. Well, yeah, we see that all the time, and you're right. Truth is, most of the time, it's the guy that's on board. And the woman, though her head's in the right place, she's thinking she's got all these attachments back home, kids, relatives, clubs, organizations, gym memberships, all that social stuff and friends she bonded with, and she'll have to give all that up. So, as it turns out, most males up in the States who've been well tuned in to the alternative media are really on with the Plan B thing. And, of course, there are plenty of ladies up in the States fully tuned in to alternative media that would like to have a Plan B, but they find it more difficult than men to let go of things. For example, if it's a married couple, it's usually the woman who says, "We need to ship down a container." Generally, it's the women who have lots of keepsakes, stuff they're attached to. Well, the fact is, at least you can get everything you need down here in a way of physical comforts. Even anything you want from the internet, Amazon, eBay, whatever. And Skype, even though I hate the way they track you with it, has been a boon to newbies who come down who have a hankering to talk to their friends and family quite a bit. And normally, when you first get down, there's a lot of that. But funny enough, it tapers off quite a bit as the months roll on. Oh, and by the way, for those of you coming to my Expat Insider Seminar, Bitcoin Dan, you know, has developed his own Skype-like end-to-end encrypted voice over internet chat and babble program. He developed it just because he's a libertarian and hates when people get spied on. He's a tremendous lover of privacy, so he spent about a half a year creating a Skype-like program that's much better and more secure and solid than Skype. And the downside? Well, there is no downside, unless you like to see the other person on camera. Well, there isn't a camera option, which is completely all right with me. You know, when you're on camera, it's insecure. If some nefarious hacker organization or scumbag government, are there any other kinds? Well, you know, they can plant bots and malware in your computer anytime. In fact, they are doing it all the time. And some of that software can control your camera. You know, NSA and government agencies have programs that can read lips now from hundreds of feet away. Don't believe me? Look it up. Which is why I always recommend you put a piece of tape over your camera. Duct tape, not masking tape. Anyway, for those lucky people coming down to my July 2018 Expat Insider Seminar, it starts in around 3 weeks now, at least from the day this show goes out. Well, Bitcoin Dan's going to be there giving a presentation, and you'll also get a link to the free copy of that special software I was just talking about, where you can talk or chat with anyone in the world completely anonymously, encrypted at both ends. Now, don't fool yourself when you see these voice over internet protocols that say they're encrypted. Yeah, the data will be encrypted all right when it ends up at the server, however hundreds or thousands of miles away that is. But the raw unencrypted part can be snapped up once it leaves your computer and ends up at the server where it's supposed to be encrypted. So anywhere in between your computer and the server, your data is wide open. So the only way to go, obviously, is end-to-end decryption. That means it's encrypted at your computer before it goes out. It flies across the ether, hits a few servers, and lands in the other guy, the recipient's computer, where it's decrypted right there. But I digress as usual. Where were we? Oh, yeah. Talking about how it can be hard, especially in the first 6 months to a year, away from all the things you knew and loved up in the States. Though in reality, you may not have loved them all, or you wouldn't have a plan B going, right? But there are things, obviously, you're going to miss. Not the creature comforts, not anymore. However, I do hear from ladies on occasion. They tell me how they're going to miss their kids and their grandkids, the ladies in the tennis club, a few neighbors, not all, that's for sure, and Julio, the pool boy. Ooh. And my answer to that is always, go back and visit once in a while, or do as I do. Ship the ones you miss down every year or two. In fact, it's much better to do that because they'll see exactly why you moved down, and then you can rub it in. And the truth is, everyone who's visited me from the States, or family and friends I've shipped down, is truly envious of this kind of lifestyle. But they'll only really get to see that after down here experiencing it with you. Otherwise, if you're just Skyping or WhatsApping with them, whatever, there's still that shadow of doubt in their minds that right around the corner, you'll always be in harm's way. Because that's the kind of news that leads up in the States. I mean, try to think. Have you ever heard any good news coming out of Latin America? And really, the whole thing is kind of counterintuitive or even ass backwards. What I mean is, it seems that in most all cases where you hear bad news about any Latin country, those are exactly the countries you should be looking at seriously for your Plan B destination. Because you see, the more bad news, the fewer the gringos. The fewer the gringos, the lower the cost of living. The lower the cost of living, the happier you are. And also, the fewer the gringos, the more the locals like and appreciate the gringos who are there. And the fewer of us there are, the less likely you'll be hit with those famous gringo prices. Because with few gringos around, the average Latin person does not come in contact with enough gringos to even have developed a two-tier pricing system yet. So as far as setting up a Plan B, you have to look at your destinations like a contrarian looks at investments. In other words, when some kind of market, any kind of market's suffering bad press, that's the time to buy. Not at the top or when everyone's riding it up. Of course, there are exceptions to everything, and the exceptions to that rule in Latin America are, of course, Venezuela, Mexico, Cuba, and Nicaragua. In the case of Cuba, Venezuela, and Nicaragua, they've got hardcore socialist iron jockstrap dictators running those countries. That means the people in those countries really have no rights at all. And now, of course, the contrarian method of setting up a Plan B also applies to good news. When you hear all this great stuff coming out of Ecuador and Uruguay, Colombia, Panama, Costa Rica, Belize, well, those should be red flags, signals that the boat just may have already sailed a long time ago. But you knew that already, right? All right, speaking of Cuba, you know, I'm not recommending it for anyone's Plan B, but if you want to take a vacation and see some strange and interesting things that surely won't exist for long, check out Cuba. At least have a look. Just don't go thinking you're going to start a business down there. That won't happen. And don't think, if you're well connected to the internet like most people are these days, that you're ever going to have the kind of connectivity you have up in Cleveland. In fact, I think today I'm going to fulfill a quote I've been meaning to get to with all the emails I have in a big file. People wondering about Cuba. And a lot of these listeners, by the way, they're Americans, of course, but they've got a Cuban relation in the family, either by marriage or they've got some Cuban blood themselves, and you know. Miami's got about as many exiled Cubans as Havana. Did I say Miami? My mistake. My jammy. And you know, since 59, Castro's revolution, every Cuban in the United States feels he's been wronged and wants to see the place restored back to a republic or democracy or whatever. And all of them wish to go back someday just to hang out or reclaim the land that's been taken from their relatives. So today we're going to hit on a lot of things Cuban, and it's well encapsulated in this report I'm going to read. Just came hot off the presses a few days ago. And of course, I'll paraphrase as usual, whether I need to or not, because it's my show. Now, most of this stuff's taken directly from an interview. He's a very brilliant guy, an investor, who just went down and spent some time there to check out if it really is a place for gringos and expats to live, work, play, especially invest. By the way, he is a contrarian investor, thinking that there are lots of opportunities in Cuba. Like he says, when you go with the crowd, you almost never make money. Just a little disclaimer here. I stay far away from traditional markets myself. I've never done well there. I'd be better off going to Vegas. All right, so let's get at it. Pay attention to what this guy has to say, because in a lot of ways, it's a comment on both what's happening in Cuba and up in the States. The title is Visit Cuba While You Still Can. This comes from E.B. Tucker. Says, last week, I managed to trigger a U.S. Treasury Department OFAC complete freeze of my brokerage account. Yep, it was a complete freeze. The push of one button by some unknown jerk in the bowels of government blocked me from any action in all four accounts I hold at Fidelity. Now, the OFAC is the Treasury Department's Office of Foreign Assets Control. Its mission is to prevent funds, supposedly, from flowing to any entity under U.S. sanctions. That means if you send money to a terrorist group or a rogue regime like North Korea, Iran, and Cuba, you too can have your brokerage accounts frozen. You see, my problem started, he says, when a Fidelity supervisor called me to say they'd made an error in my account the prior day, so it wasn't even my fault. So that stuff happened to me. But why? Could it be because the very next day I was headed for Havana, Cuba? So even with that mess at Fidelity, I couldn't take care of it because I was leaving. When I got home, I had to visit the local office, though, in person and show them my passport. And once they saw it, and the fact that I was physically in the U.S. now, they unfroze my accounts. Now, I'm not sure why my mere mention of traveling to Havana triggered such an overreaction. I have no idea how a terrorist group or rogue regime could possibly benefit from anything I could do in my brokerage account. That's weird. To me, he says, the whole incident is more proof that the U.S. is really in a full-scale police state. We have hundreds of thousands of mindless enforcers from TSA to overzealous call center supervisors at Fidelity even. They follow orders without checking things out. But why did this happen just because I mentioned Cuba? Well, traveling to Cuba is not actually against the law, not anymore. However, the law is extremely complicated. You can visit, yes, but you can't stay in certain hotels, for instance. Americans can only transact business with Cuban people, not in international hotels, even though there are plenty of them. This means staying in a house, a casa particular, private home, and dining at only privately owned little restaurants. I'm talking about if you're an American now. And by the way, as far as privately owned restaurants, there aren't many. Now, there are B&Bs in Cuba, and they do qualify because private Cubans own them, or sort of own them. Now, this is my second trip to Havana. First was in 2013. Funny enough, my local Cuban friend said, if you're going down there to invest, you missed the boom. It's over already. Then he says, after my last trip in 2013, I watched the cash flow into Cuba, expecting things, obviously, to open up. Then 2015 and 2016 were the boom years in Havana. I saw many buildings that were dilapidated on my first trip that were now fully refurbished. In fact, one of them went from ruins to a brand new five-star Kempinski brand hotel. So we stopped in for a cigar and found there were only two people in the entire lounge. We were outnumbered by the staff 5-1. All right, it's me, Johnny, again. Now, really, that's nothing unusual at all anywhere in Latin America. You'll often be in a place, there'll be only two or three clients. Could be very upscale place or even middle class. Doesn't matter. You'll often see you're outnumbered 5-1 as far as the help, which is why gringos are always saying, how can this place stay in business? Now, you long-time listeners know the answer to that. Down here, you can hire 5 people for the price of 1 up in the States. And the rent's half as cheap or less. There's no insurance to pay. And on, lots of reasons. Anyway, he says, I attended a friend's birthday dinner and sat next to a guy named Jose, who was president of Spanish bank Banco Sabadell's Cuban joint venture bank. He told me that his friend manages the Kempinski Hotel property in Old Havana. He said that getting supplies to run a hotel in Cuba is simply a nightmare. Sometimes there's just no lettuce, for example, at all. Not for a day, for a week. That's just how things go in Cuba, he says. And we're talking about a five-star international hotel. Then he says, it's sort of understood from what I hear the Cuban military owns some of the new luxury hotels in Old Havana. They negotiate long-term operating leases with companies like Kempinski. Now, Americans can't stay there because allegedly it's a backdoor way of funneling money to the military sector. Now, he says, back when I visited Cuba in 2013, it took me 23 hours to get there from Florida. First, I flew to Cancun. Went from Cancun on Cubana Airline to buy a ticket from Havana, but the flight was full. I had to buy a ticket then to Panama, and then another ticket to Havana. All right, me, Johnny, here again. Two things there so we can stay on track. One is almost all big Latin American airports now have flights directly to Havana. That's how I did it last time. I've been there a couple times now. Last time I went straight from Panama. However, just recently, trying to get there from the States is not so bad. Then, when he talks about the shortages of food, etc., even at five-star hotels, I remember last time I went, I stayed at a five-star hotel, Melia. A lot of Spanish hotel chains down there. and surprisingly enough, Canadian chain hotels. And the buffets were huge. And some days, sure, they were missing things, but they made up for it by having more of others. And by the way, when talking to one of the waiters at the breakfast buffet, man, that guy was so happy to be working there. Overly polite, all smiles. Not much like the Cuban people on the street, who seem a little reserved and dour even. Anyway, there are two older Canadian guys at the table next to me. They heard the conversation and one turned to me and said, "Hey there, you're darn right they love working here. Because after every meal they get to eat the leftovers." And I said, "You're kidding, right?" And he said, "You ain't been here long, huh?" And then he left and I got the point. All right, then the article says, "This trip was much easier than the early ones. I flew this time from Tampa, Florida to Havana on Southwest Airlines. Took under an hour. The flight cost around $200. Booked it right on Southwest website with my credit card. However," he says, "when you do buy your ticket to Cuba, Southwest will send you a scary email warning you about travel precautions there. But don't worry about it. As long as you adhere to the rules, which are intentionally confusing as usual, you'll be fine." Then he says, "Next thing you have to do is get a visa. I bought one at a Cuban travel store in West Tampa for $80. You can now get them at most Florida airports that offer flights to Cuba. The problem is they sometimes run out of them, so do it ahead of time. Now here's the kicker, and there's a lot of kickers. When you arrive in Cuba, you'll need to spend their local money, and they have a two-tier currency system. The locals use pesos, and the gringos use CUC, or Cuban convertible pesos. One is supposed to be par with a dollar, but you lose 13% instantly when you buy them." Then he says, "Keep in mind it's technically illegal to change money outside of a licensed vendor. However, you'll find people offering change around the airport. Of course, that's illegal. And you might have to take it because U.S. dollars are useless when you're looking to get a taxi." Then he says, "You must remember this. A kiss is but a kiss." Da-da-da-da-da-da. No, he didn't. He just said, "You must remember this. Remember, your credit cards, debit cards, ATM cards, checks, and traveler's checks are completely useless in Cuba. You must have crisp, brand new $100 bills with you, and they have to be the blue ones, the new ones, with the little Mylar strip in them. All right, me Johnny here again. Yeah, I remember last time I was in Cuba, the blue $100 bills weren't much in circulation at all, and they'd only take pristine U.S. dollars because, as one vendor told me, tremendous amount of counterfeit bills coming in, and the Cubans weren't making them, but foreigners, generally Asians, were bringing them in," he said. All right, then he says, "Getting around is a big hassle in Havana." Boy, did I find that out. "In fact, everything in Havana is a big hassle. If you decide to make the trip, which I strongly encourage, simply because it's another world that probably won't exist in a couple of years. Anyway, the fact is you'll need to completely abandon any hope of keeping on a schedule. They're not just on Mañana Time, they're on Mañana Time Squared. Since your U.S. cell phone won't work, depending on your age, you're definitely going to have some digital device withdrawal. Because you'll be back in the 1960s again. Meaning old farts will acclimate easily. So anyway," he says, "just for you newbies, I made up this itinerary, a little schedule if you're going to go down for a couple of days. It'll serve you well. But," he says, "I don't suggest you go there for more than a week because your first trip tackling Havana will certainly be enough. And once you know what you're getting into, maybe you'll come back for a longer trip. Maybe not. So anyway, here's how you might plan it. Day one, arrive, change money, relax. Don't plan on doing anything. Day two, take a taxi to Old Havana. Ask the driver to take you down to Malecón, which hugs the water and passes the strange, empty U.S. embassy. Visit El Florida, which has a statue of Ernest Hemingway at the end of the bar. Have a cigar at Kempinski's, the second floor lounge of that five-star hotel. Day three, take a taxi to El Moro Castle on the east bank of the entrance to the Havana Harbor. Make sure to pay for a round trip. If you don't, you'll have a hard time getting back to the city. Once there, walk around the grounds and enjoy the view. On the way back, stop for a drink at Hotel Nacional de Cuba, which opened in 1930. That's where Meyer Lansky, Lucky Luciano, Traficante Castello, and Joe Banano always hung out. Have dinner at El Cocinero on Calle 26, that's Street 26. The restaurant looks like an old power plant with a brick smokestack. Day four, remember this is a short trip, so it's departure day. The airport will be a nightmare. There's about a 1% chance that your flight will actually leave on time, so plan on sitting around for a while. On the way, have your taxi driver take you by La Casa del Habanero, a store in the lobby of the Melilla Hotel on 3rd Avenue, if you need to stock up on Cuban cigars. If you can manage, ask him to drive through the Cubanacan neighborhood on the way to the airport. Specifically, check out the U.S. Ambassador's residence. It's a mansion on 5 acres. You won't believe it. The neighborhood was a country club before the revolution. Then he says, regarding cigars, just don't buy them anywhere. Fake cigars are big business in Havana. Don't buy from any people on the street. Make sure you visit a licensed store. I like to shop in the Melia Hotel, he says. The prices are great and the staff is helpful. Yep, me Johnny here. That's the hotel I stayed at. And from what this letter says, I don't know why they let me stay there, being an American and all. Then he says, if you're not a cigar aficionado, feel free to buy cheap cigars anywhere in the market. They're also great. They're dirt cheap. The name brands are what people take time to fake. Now, the way U.S. Customs is, you can bring back 2 boxes of cigars. That's 50 total. Make sure you declare them with Customs or you'll be sent to a secondary waiting room and lose your cigars and probably your connecting flight, too. And finally, he says, you really should take the trip to Cuba, if you have the mind to, while you can, because things are getting worse. The tail end of Obama's term offered some hope of opening up, but that's all over now. Things are back to normal, a crumbling state of deterioration. So in the end, it's a complicated pain in the ass to get there and get around, but first thing you'll notice with the regular people is that their life is simple. All right, meet Johnny with a few final words on Cuba. He's talking about how they fake name brand cigars. That would be Cohiba, what Castro used to smoke before his doctor made him quit. Also, Romeo y Julieta, Bolivar's, Davidoff's, Dunhill's, and a few other well-known brands. Figure it this way. If they're good enough to be put into nicely finished aluminum tubes, there are going to be fakes around. However, you long, long, long-time listeners might remember the story I told when I went to a Cuban cigar factory where they had the tattered sign in Spanish that said, all of our cigars are rolled on the thighs of Cuban virgins. Oh, they were ladies, all right. Virgins, I kind of doubted because most of them didn't have their natural teeth. Anyway, the lady tour operator advised us not to buy cigars at one of the registered shops. She said she had a cigar connection. Everyone's got a cigar connection. A brother or uncle who worked at one of the factories. And you see, they're allowed to smoke, buy, and take out the rejects. So what's a reject? Slight tear or miscolored wrapper? Pretty much stuff that you and I would find impossible to detect. So anyway, I ended up buying a couple boxes from a guy who came right out the back door of the cigar factory. So fakes, yeah, there's plenty of them. But man, when the guy's walking out the back door of a real national cigar factory, you gotta believe they just might be coming from the thighs of those toothless virgins. You think? You've been listening to the Expat Files Living in Latin America. If you need some help with your own Plan B, you can schedule a one-on-one phone call with me. But first, download my free Plan B questionnaire at www.thenewexpat.com. Better yet, if you want to get your Plan B going from right up there in the States, just sign up for my 9-hour Expat Essentials course. Get the perfect Plan B blueprint by going to theexpatfiles.com/academy. Nos vemos!